Welcome to Six Picks Music Club. Bonus content.
All right, well, I have a really special treat for us today. Russ, actually, when he was prepping info for his track, actually reached out to the band, and we have Chris Phillips from I Am Dynamite with us here on the pod. Chris, welcome to Six Picks Music Club. It's so great to have you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Heck yeah. So this episode, we were picking tracks for each other where we think that this is something that the other one's going to like, and Russ actually picked your song for me.
Okay.
And it's funny because growing up as a kid, my parents, they, you know, made up nicknames for us that they wanted to have like a positive thing for or whatnot. So my brother's Mighty Mike and I'm Dynamite Dave. So it's
nice.
Like, it was so funny that he's like, hey, it's a funny coincidence that the song I picked for you is.
Yeah, you're literally part of the family. That's perfect.
So I was a fan before you even heard the track, but the Corner Street track, your new track that came out 2022.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Thanks.
I think just the first time I heard it, it's got sort of like a late 90s bass line that kind of makes me think of that Nick Hexum project, The Urge, or yep. Like a little 311 thing going on. And I really dug it. So I wanted to kind of get your feel for it. And because it's also a little bit different from an energy tempo side than some of your earlier stuff. And I'm curious, like,
yeah.
Talk a little bit about where you feel like the band is growing and how that track came together.
The other Chris and I have known each other for, I mean, years and years and years. We went to high school together. When we were like figuring out our instruments, it was grunge. We talked to our high school band last night because I was playing Radiohead and I was like, hey guys, I'm playing Radiohead. And we used to play Radiohead and Nirvana. We used to do Spoon Man. We used to do it all.
Yeah.
And then really heavily on Rage, very much kind of that scene growing up. We were in bands throughout college and this band was actually called Mahoney at one point, named after Steve Guttenberg's character in Police Academy, which we thought was the best thing ever.
Yeah.
When we got signed, we actually went down and played South by Southwest as Mahoney. And then that quickly turned into we're now, you know, if we're ever going to change the name, maybe not so cheeky, maybe a little bit more serious. So we went through it, ended up working out. I Am Dynamite was the new name. We got out of, you know, like legal stuff and bad managers and all that kind of stuff just by changing the name. So anyway.
That's nice.
The Nietzsche quote is fantastic. I'd never heard that before either.
Yeah. So the other Chris was reading Existentialism for Dummies at the moment we were trying to like change the name. I mean, this is the true story.
Yeah.
So he was definitely like, dude, I think this is really cool. And then his wife actually made our first logo, which is why there's no spaces. She just made it look like a neon sign. And we were like, that's actually really cool. So
that's awesome.
That's kind of how that happened. We were raised by kind of, you know, grunge. And like you said, the early 90s stuff. The first album was basically, this is how we make a duo really fun live at a bar. And we were playing like Neil Diamond and we were doing all that stuff. That's why like Walk Like an Egyptian came out. Like we were doing that live just to keep everybody entertained.
Sure.
So that was that first album, right? And so obviously went down to Texas, recorded that at Willie Nelson's old studio, which is still there. I feel like it was one of the last major projects that came out of there. And we definitely broke his tape machine, the tech that was there. Because we recorded that first album to tape. And I think he used the wrong kind of tape and it never worked after that.
Oh, no.
It wasn't my fault. I can say it out loud. We toured forever on that first album. Second album, we actually lived in different states.
So you grew up in Michigan, right? Ann Arbor. And then you moved to North Carolina.
So we both moved to North Carolina. Gosh, I don't even remember when that was the first time. I've been down here 15 years, right? So, I mean, this is home to me, even though my entire family's still up Detroit, Ann Arbor area. Then Chris moved back to Michigan. So for 7.5 years, we were literally 700 miles apart. The writing the second album was like, he basically sat at his place, wrote that second album, would send me stuff to work on or do whatever. I mean, we recorded that a little bit too early, kind of in our thought. We recorded it in the summer, obviously came out of that second album. Bloom was our second single out of there. We play it live a lot different than we recorded it. Basically, because we were so far away from each other and didn't actually even, we never practiced really was what it was. It kind of took on a life of its own and we threw everything against the wall to see what stuck. And everything stuck.
Nice.
We didn't peel anything back, which is a complete shift from the first album, right?
Okay.
That first album was literally drums, guitar, and some overdubs, and that's it. Which is fine. I mean, some people were kind of like, oh, this isn't I Am Dynamite. Whatever, man. It was I Am Dynamite. We wrote it. That's how we felt at that point. Who cares, right?
Yeah.
So that's quickly turned into this development of who we are as a band. I mean, we're not afraid of running tracks, even though like my bandmate hates it. I don't necessarily hate it. It kind of keeps me honest. It keeps me in time, like especially because we click everything anyway, and everything's pretty regimented because we want to stay good, right?
Yeah.
So Corner Street came out of, obviously when COVID hit, no shows, no anything. So we wrote a batch of songs. Corner Street's the one that survived. You know, okay. Everything else was, I mean, I don't want to say trash, but everything else was different. A lot of slower tempo stuff, which is not our forte, but like just kind of, that's how everybody was. When you can't test stuff out live and see reactions, for us anyway,
sure,
it's really hard to be like, oh, that's a banger. You know, this is more like, okay, like this feels good, but is it going to translate to any audience? You know?
Right.
It's like a stand-up comic who doesn't test out their jokes and then goes out to record a special and bombs. Yeah, I got it.
Yes, 100%. Dude, I read that. I read Steve Martin's autobiography back in the day. That was my toilet book, right? Like every time I was on the toilet, I read that book.
I love that.
I read that and it was the same thing. You have to constantly be out there pushing, and you'd rather bomb at some small club, or for us, play some really terrible song at some small club, which we did, and see, like it just isn't going to work. So anyway, Corner Street came about. We pushed it to radio ourselves. So it got some radio play, some stations that we had relationships with. They loved it down here in Raleigh. It was fun, but it's bass heavy. It was recorded down back in Texas at Orb Studios.
That's where you did the second album as well, right?
Yep. Second album with Matt Nevesky, who owns, mm-hmm. co-owns that studio.
Okay.
And then we ended up doing that sans Matt. So it was literally the engineer, Chris and I. So we produced that thing ourselves. Now, granted, we always ask Matt's permission because he's a good buddy of ours. It was our first real thing into like, let's just do this on our own. Now, granted, are there things that we would have changed? Absolutely. Like even now, we played a little bit different, a little bit more groovy, but the bones of that song are still very much the exact same. Because that came out at a time where like we weren't necessarily playing shows quite yet, it was kind of interesting to see like people's reaction, that you almost like, oh man, they're back. They want to do shows and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So then when that finally came out, we started doing shows. We'd go upstate New York to the radio station up there, EQX, or I think it's still EQX. We played a big festival up there. 2023, because that song came out, I believe in 22, right at the end of COVID. And so—
April 22.
Yep. And we actually recorded two songs. We'll talk about that next song later. But we ended up going out in August, I believe, of 22. And my foot goes numb driving, not through New York City, but I was like in Jersey. And we're driving the trailer up and gear. And you know, we had our little crew guy. And we're doing this thing. And my foot goes numb. And I'm like, I didn't say anything to anybody. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I'd been dealing with a little injury. And I was like, oh, okay, I should probably get this checked out. So we get to the hotel, I take my shoe off, everything's okay. I play the show, everything's fine. And had a couple shows that summer, basically radio shows promoting Corner Street. And man, my foot's just bothering me. So I go and get it checked out. And I got a shout out to Duke Ortho, right? So I got it checked out. I had a bone spur developed from an old injury. And that bone spur punctured my Achilles tendon.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I was following your medical journey.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the scar that they had to scrape.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, dude. Yeah. I mean, it was, so everyone says, like, obviously with Aaron Rodgers doing his crap, like totally faking his injury on the Jets, you know, everyone's like, dude, he's walking like 3 weeks later. Well, I didn't rupture my Achilles. I had a bone spur growth right straight through it and like working its way out of my skin. Anyway, what they did is they went in, they cut the back of my heel, they cut my Achilles up and down, and then reshaped my entire heel bone.
Ugh.
And then put it all back together. So I could not put any weight on it for 8 to 10 weeks, right? So I was in a cast, I was in all this stuff. So clearly, end of 2022, actually surgery was March 3rd, 2023. So I had done so much stuff beforehand, but I had to be careful. I couldn't, it wasn't going to rupture, but it was hurting, right?
Yeah.
I did a couple other projects. I went down to Orb and recorded with a buddy of mine that January. I ended up trying to push as much as I possibly could. And then March 3rd, I was laid up and it's my right foot. So
your bass drum foot?
Bass drum foot. I couldn't drive. I couldn't do anything.
Kind of important. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually talked about a few times, like how could we play shows within that time? Because it was almost a tour that we were on. And I was like, actually, it would be, because I had a knee scooter. Right. So I'm like, how awesome would I feel at being the drummer and schlepping gear around for years, how cool would it be for me to just roll up there with a tambourine and sing?
Yeah.
And like scoot around the stage. And I was in, I was sold. I actually had a buddy of mine here, cleared it with his wife. He was going to come play, like play drums in the background. And I was like, dude, take care of our gear. It sounded awesome to me just to not do anything except I couldn't even drive.
Right.
Yeah. Like that to me, it was like, oh, I finally get a break and I don't have to do anything.
Oh, so it's like, it's like actual rock star time. You know?
Yeah, dude. I was sold, man. So anyway, it
it's
ended
like
up
your
not
Ariana
happening.
Grande moment. Yes. Like, I have to be carried.
Exactly. Right. I'm a big dude. I don't know if anybody, I couldn't hire a bunch of all those people to carry me. But anyway, so yeah. So it didn't end up working out, obviously. But yeah, then all this happened, did my rehab, finally was able to start playing. And as I was able to start playing, and we were about to do a local show, my bandmate, Chris, they ended up having baby number two. By this time, it's already August. We had to cancel the local show, which we hate doing anything. We hate canceling shows. We've played two local shows just to test some waters, all new songs and Corner Street. But no joke, it's all new songs, working on new material. Since the baby was born, since the most of the year is already gone, Chris, the other Chris, he ended up looking at me and he was like, hey man, my knee's been bugging me. So Thanksgiving week, he had a MCL replacement and then an ACL something.
Whoa.
So he ended up having knee surgery. So 2023 for I Am Dynamite was a medical wash. So it kind of sucked because yes, we had a little bit of like momentum going with Corner Street.
Yeah.
But it's better that we had a song, we got it out there. We know, man, in today's world, you got to get stuff out. We get it, but like what are we supposed to do when I physically can't play? We'll hit it hard in 2024. And we've been working since then. I mean, really when we could start playing, even with his knee surgery, he did a show in Charlotte, North Carolina, where he had to sit and he had a knee brace. I wasn't 100%, so I'm still like holding his amp and I'm sitting there like, okay, got to like take like 25 steps, put the amp down, stretch my ankle, keep it going. And he can't do anything. Mm. So it was a nightmare, but it was, you know, we ended up making it through, but yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now. But new songs are coming. Corner Street is still on that set list. But yeah, it's very much, it sucks that it's been taking so long, but when you can't physically play,
yeah,
and it's not even a mental health thing with us. It was physical health. We couldn't actually do anything. So it is what it is, but that's where we're at right now.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the process of living in different locations. I feel like a lot of bands had to figure that out during COVID, but you guys were already, you're already down that road. Like what, how did you make that work? How were you sending each other things?
Yeah, it was just sending Dropbox, sending WAV files, just sending different ways of doing things. I mean, there was a song off Wauwatosa that I learned on the airplane going to Texas.
Oh, cool.
Things were a little bit different and scary.
You just got like a practice pad in the exit row and, and someone's sitting next to you like, what the hell is this guy doing?
Yeah, with pencils hitting the back of the seat. I was that guy. But you just got to be aware. Like we knew what was coming. And then we got a random call from Live Nation that we were selected to open up for Bon Jovi at Joe Louis Arena in Detroit.
Whoa.
Right. So this was years ago. So
in Detroit, in your hometown?
In a hometown. And I lived in North Carolina. So I'm like, oh, crap. So no joke. I drive up. We did one like kind of rehearsal and then one vocal rehearsal and then went and played in front of 12,000 people.
Dang.
It was not a comfortable feeling. But we did good. And then a year after that, this is all pre-COVID, a year after that, we're down here in Raleigh. Chris had since moved back down to Raleigh. Chris and his wife, they're living in Durham. And so we were like practiced up, ready to go. And we're like, oh man. So I tease sometimes that Bon Jovi, John Bon Jovi himself, saved this band from just not breaking up, but just being like, hey man, it was a good run.
Yeah.
Yeah. We ended up doing that thing in Detroit. And he was like, this is stupid. If I want this band to work, I cannot live in Michigan while you live in North Carolina. So it was like, so, and my wife, like her job brought us down here. So it's not like I'm moving back, you know?
Right.
Plus I don't like snow.
I hear that. We live in Texas, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When it snows, it's like, oh God, what did we do?
They shut everything down. Yeah.
Yes. Everything shuts down. Yeah.
Somebody sacrifice a goat.
Right, right, right.
As a drummer and a singer, a vocalist, I feel like that's a really challenging thing. There's not a lot of drummer singers out there. So Levon Helm's a great example of a singer drummer. Who are some other drummers that are great vocalists in your Hall of Fame?
I mean, Phil Collins.
obviously.
People don't realize Phil Collins was an amazing drummer. He was Genesis drummer and then took over the vocals. So like, it's not all just Tarzan soundtrack for Phil Collins, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, they like...
Going into the dad space with the Tarzan soundtrack reference.
Although, man, you listen to that soundtrack and you're like, as a drummer, you're like...
That slaps. Yeah. Okay.
I get it.
He's in the pocket. That's good.
Levon being one of them, if you know, that's something to strive for, just his groove in general while being able to lead. But I mean, it's just something that naturally just kind of happened. Both my parents were vocalists, instrumentalists. I'm a weirdo. I have a music degree. So like I did all my theory. I did this, like I had a class at 7:50 in the morning in college called oral harmony, where it was like, play this note, sing a third above it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had to work on all this stuff on top of, you know, learning jazz and Latin and all this other drum stuff. So it just kind of happens. I think about the drum parts first.
Okay.
And then when they're done, all I think about is singing. When I'm playing live or doing whatever, if you see me with my eyes closed, it's because I'm trying to sing the right notes. I could care less of what's happening on the drums, right?
You know where the kid is. I can hit that.
I know where the kid is. I hear the click. I know what the tempo is, but like, it's more of I'm only trying to sing right because that's not what I'm best at. I'm better at drums. It's the same thing. I've watched, you know, things with Phil Collins. He's not a singer that plays drums. He's a drummer that just happens to sing okay. It's kind of that same thing.
There's a video of him doing In the Air Tonight where he's just like walking around the stage real slow.
Yeah.
Like as he's singing the intro part. And then he gets up and it's just like such an anticipatory thing when he finally sits down at the kit and then just like blasts into that drum hit. It's awesome.
There's definitely times live that he has made that so dramatic where he like steps on the kit and just kind of goes, looks around. And then does the
ready?
Fill.
You want it? You want it enough? I'll give it to you. And
exactly.
Then, bam. No, that's awesome. So about talking about how you guys write music, do you write together? Do lyrics come first? Does music come first? What's y'all's?
Lyrics are always last. That's a Chris Martin thing. There's definitely been times where songs come really fast. He usually starts with the idea. There's been a few times where like I'll come up with a beat. And that kind of shifts things.
Oh, yeah.
Very few times. It really starts with an idea in Chris's head. Clearly, why Wasatusa took a long time and why it wasn't as good as the first album is because we were not together. We did not rehearse together, write together. We didn't do any of that. That is a, you know, picture perfect example of why writing together is more important. And so lyrics are always kind of weird. And if I come up with lyrics, Chris will say, dude, if you want those lyrics to be said, then you sing them. So I leave that to him, unless I have a strong opinion about something, but I leave that to him. And then we definitely bounce ideas, especially now we bounce ideas back and forth. So the writing process, even though slow as it is, there is something to be said about starting with an idea and then finishing it together for sure.
I know you and Chris were in some other bands kind of growing up together. Is that right? I read that on the internet. I don't know if that's right.
Yeah, we've been in a lot of bands together. So yeah, we started in a band called Lodestone, which was two other guys from high school. One's like a doctor and one's a teacher. So they got careers and, you know, were the poor musicians. But yeah, still keep in touch with those guys. We had a rapper too, which is, you know, because rap rock was the thing at one point. And then we...
You need a DJ, homie.
We had a thing called The Squadron, which was like four other guys. And we would do stupid things. We'd literally covered Nookie one time.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it was like, you know, back in the day. And then, we had another band. Sometimes it was a trio. Sometimes it was four guys. Another band called Median. We were like we were good sometimes. And then other times we just weren't good. And the songs weren't good. So in between all this stuff, obviously college happened. We didn't really play in college, but you know, we've known each other so long. We were friends.
You were honing your craft. You were learning about harmonic dissonance.
Exactly. And so then it ended up, as the one band dissolved after college, then it was like we both taught. So we taught at the same school in Ann Arbor. And then we were obviously started kind of this band. We had some other friends that we'd play with. One of our guys named Stefan, he ended up coming to play with us for a little bit. And it was that duo worked out. We wrote everything together. Everything was 50-50. It was just easy, right?
Yeah.
So we've learned that going along. And then obviously that took shape. And, you know, here we are years later, like, oh, that ended up working out kind of nice. So
our mutual love for Steve Guttenberg has created this whole new life.
You know, there are definitely times where like, God, like our flyers used to be just a picture of Steve Guttenberg and, nice. then the date and time of the show.
That's
it was
awesome.
Perfect. We just fantastic. Blasted around like old school, like put up flyers on all the light poles. We just do it to get people to the shows. And it was like, gosh, there was times where it was like, we should have just stuck to Mahoney.
That's,
you know, like,
funny. That's good marketing.
I mean, dude, just think of the merch. Like, we could have gotten right. him signed. He could have been in every one of our music videos. Yep. Like, it was perfect.
Yeah, call up Michael Winslow and see if he can get you some overdubs.
Oh, my gosh, dude. Oh, that would be a dream for sure. Just to get, you know, Commandant Lassard to scream into a microphone for a song or two. That'd be great.
So I know that with that first record, you all got to do a lot of touring. And yeah. you did a U.S. tour and a European tour. Did I read that right?
We ended up buying a van and we circled the U.S. easily 5 or 6 times in that van. And then up and down East Coast, you know, more than that.
Yeah.
We did Europe a couple times. The first time, our first big tour was with our buddies, Blue October. We're on the same label. We have the same management and we're tight with those guys.
Yeah, yeah. Go Texas. They're from Houston, right?
Houston. They all live in Austin. Yeah. During the U.S. tour, they asked us to come to Germany with them. So and then we ended up doing a bunch of shows in Germany with them right away. And then we went back to Europe 4 times after that, 3 or 4 times after that on our own.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Where We Go was on the charts in Germany before it was on the charts in the U.S., which is one of those stories, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But honestly, the first time that we heard the audience sing the lyrics back to us and we kept the thing going.
That's got
to
be a trip.
It was in Germany. It was in Berlin.
Nice.
That's the first time now, granted, when you're playing a big show, you can kind of hear it a little bit. This was like, he looked at me and I looked at him and we stopped singing. I remember it like yesterday, man. It was a small club in Berlin. It was our song, Carolina.
That's the song that got me into you guys. That song is, I love it.
Oh, right on. That song, it's actually really funny. We wrote that in Ann Arbor way before, and now we live in North Carolina. So it's just like this weird thing.
That's funny.
They were singing the bridge to us. And like I just kept time and they just kept singing it. I think we did it 4 or 5 times. On the record, we like break it down. We sing it 3 times and build it up. We just kept playing it. And it just kept going. And we were sitting there like, this is, and it goosebumps, right?
Yeah.
It's fun to go somewhere else. Even West Coast for us is fun to go. And it's been a while. We know it.
In 2022, before Corner Street came out, you were on another interview talking about dropping singles every 6 to 8 weeks and stuff. I guess these are songs that you guys ended up scrapping. But is that the plan for 2024? Are you guys going to do the single route? Or are you going to go back with an album?
When that happened, I think that's what everybody started to do, is like do singles, and it just pushed you to do it. After we went and recorded Corner Street and then another song called Soraya.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I did the video for Corner Street. I don't know if you saw the video.
I did. Is it Walking Downtown Durham?
We did Downtown Raleigh and Downtown Durham. Yeah.
Okay.
People just need something visually to see it. And then I also did a song of quote unquote live version of Soraya. And we filmed it in my attic in January. So we're sitting there freezing, but still playing it. We never launched it. We're not a quantity band. It was meant to push us. We want to get stuff out quickly. But if the songs suck, you know,
yeah,
a lot of Wauwatosa stuff, it didn't resonate live.
Right.
And we didn't play them. And it's like, you know, they're great songs, but it just didn't work out. So for us, it was like, man, and really everything we wrote over COVID, it just wasn't going to work. So we don't want to put out a bunch of crap. And in hopes of like hundreds or thousands of people loving it, we want to put out stuff that like everyone will love. And that's really hard. And it's a lot on us, but like we're more quality, less quantity.
Got it.
I want to put out something that I want to play forever.
Right.
That's kind of where we're at now. We'll probably end up doing a long EP instead of a full album. If we can get a long EP, which is like what, 7, 8 songs. That's our goal anyway.
That's a full album for a lot of bands.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, dude, I keep trying to buy freaking Tears for Fears on vinyl. And I'm like, it's 8 songs. Why am I going to pay $38 for a vinyl of 8 songs? Dang, man.
Yeah, so, it's gotten kind of crazy. I got bit by the jazz bug this last year and started buying some jazz records. And man, you'll find some of those Japanese jazz records from the late 70s, early 80s that have like 5 tracks on them. And they're like $80. And you're just like, nah, I can't do it.
That's great. I just bought. So my birthday was Monday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm 22.
You look great.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. Having kids really ages you. I'm just saying.
Life on the road. It's a hard life.
Yeah, exactly. So I ended up buying Radiohead, the dual album that they put out. So they put out Kid A and Amnesiac, and they put them together.
Kid Amnesiac.
Yeah, and it was like $57. And it was like on sale, on Amazon sale. And I was like, gosh, that's the most expensive vinyl I've ever owned. But then I looked at per song. It's not that bad.
It's two records. And you get the bonus stuff. So really like three. Yeah.
Exactly. So I was like, for my birthday, the truth behind it is I gave blood the other day. And I literally got a bonus. I got $70 on Amazon.
Nice.
So I was like, well, that's easy purchase.
No doubt.
Get a little bit of your life to someone else and, you know, you get a Radiohead record.
You're talking about Radiohead a couple of times and it's funny because I read a story just recently that they didn't actually get a lot of radio play when they put out Creep, and it was an Israeli radio station that picked that up, and they were this huge hit over in Israel before they were even big in the UK, and they were doing that same thing where they were touring and they were like, they're singing the song back to us. This is crazy. Yeah.
We actually have a lot of listeners in Brazil, which
fun.
Because you can see all that stuff on Spotify now.
Yeah.
So it's like US number one, Mexico number two, and Brazil number three. And it's like, wait a minute. Like, I would love to go to Brazil.
Yeah.
Sao Paulo is calling.
Now, granted, we do have full-time jobs, but we're both educators. We both do music lessons. Me, not as much as Chris. Chris got like 40 guitar students. Like, he's got like a whole thing going. So if we go on tour, we need to make sure business-wise, we're making enough money that Chris's kids can eat.
Right.
You know, so it's a very much like, oh, it doesn't hinder us, right? But it's definitely like, we have to be well aware as working adults. The years of going out and making $100 and driving a van around, that doesn't happen anymore.
The quote when you guys are talking about eating the one cracker every 3 days and all that, yeah. Right? Like, that's not the case anymore.
We had this crew guy named Jay. Shout out to Jay. We used to go to Walmart. We get a box of Wheat Thins. And if it was if we're doing good, we got a real Wheat Thins. If not, we got the great value Wheat Thins. And we'd get cans of tuna.
Yeah.
So the first official like band purchase, like the band actually paid for it, was a can opener. And we used to just, that was our meal. We would, at lunch, we'd crack open a can of tuna and eat it with Wheat Thins. Dude, that's how we ate on the road. But it was amazing. And every now and then it was like, we'd like steal the mayonnaise packets, like from like whatever restaurant we were at. We'd steal as many of them as we can to like make it real tuna fish. He couldn't stand the smell of tuna fish. We'd do it in the secret in the back of the van, and he'd be driving and he would just be like, guys, who opened soon? It was like the craziest thing ever. But I mean, yeah, you do what you can to survive. Honestly, we still have that can opener. It's still in the van. New van, but it's still in the van. And my kids have definitely been like, why is there a can opener here? And I'm like, hey,
just
man,
in case.
You never know.
You never know when that tuna thing is going to follow.
Oh, awesome. Talk a little bit about how your musical taste has changed over the years. Has it, as a dad, because we're both fathers, and I have albums that I need my children to know and listen to. Like, we were listening to Black Sabbath the other day in the car, and I was like, you really need to listen to this. So they're like, can we listen to Taylor Swift, please? And no, we're listening to Ozzy.
So my oldest is going to be 16 next week. I've gone through like creating them a Spotify playlist. I've definitely put on a lot of Fleetwood Mac, a lot of like, you know, a lot of different things where I'm just like, hey, you need to know this stuff. Granted, you know, she grew up watching me on stages and all this stuff. My son, who's eight or going to be eight, he doesn't recollect. Like, he saw me play with Bon Jovi and do all this stuff, but he was like 3 and 4. So he sees the old pictures. He doesn't get it. So like my daughters saw me play on stages, saw this music kind of happen at that time. They like it. And clearly my studio is in the house, right? So he knows I play drums. He sees all the pictures. He hears the albums. Like, he understands. But this might be a controversial hot take, but like,
bring it.
You know, Disney and DreamWorks, like all the animated stuff, like Soul, for instance. Like, dude, Trent Reznor did Soul.
Yeah.
That allowed me to be like, hey, check this out. Here's Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Frozen 2. Like, the dude from Panic at the Disco sang it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Right.
What my kids freaking loved was I turned, and I'm not going to do it because I'll peek the mic out. I turned the that thing was into Brush Your Teeth. So at night, I'm like in my entrance, and my kids are fighting me about going to bed, and I'm just saying, brush your teeth. And like the fact that dad can hit it and they're like, they just eyes get big and they're like, oh, okay. Like
that's awesome.
I feel like they've allowed things. It's not just artists doing it because the kids grew up in the generation of musical soundtracks again, even though they're redone. Like, dude, I still freaking, I'm a weirdo, right? I love Beauty and the Beast, but the Peebo Bryson version, mm-hmm. dude, Peebo Bryson is the man, right? Like,
yeah.
If you listen to any of that stuff, old, all the old stuff, like that's how it was. That's when it was cool. I loved that. Now, granted, yeah, I also lived through Let It Go. I lived through listening to that song 35 times a day.
yes.
Because, again, I had daughters. Yep. I mean, it's on the radio. Like, and when it's on the radio, I usually tend to sing it at the top of my lungs just to avoid listening to the whole song. Because then the girls are like, all right, Dad, we get it. And they'll change the channel.
That's all. I remember at the time when Spotify started doing the rap, like, here are your top 100 songs. And yeah. Let It Go was my number one. I'm like, oh, that hurts me so badly.
I know, right? I tried to listen to anything else to like make that algorithm change, but I have basically one in high school, one in middle school, one in elementary school. It does range, but I want to make sure if I'm cool enough to curate some of their musical tastes, I will. Like, I want them to listen to freaking Birdland by Buddy Rich. Like, I want that. So, you know, they might not like it. Like, no joke, yesterday, we keep saying Radiohead, but I'm on this Radiohead kick right now. I was listening to that album and like doing the dishes and my daughter comes in and she goes, ew, Dad, what is this? And I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
You do not in this house.
Yeah, I was like, shut up and listen. And she doesn't get it quite yet. And she might, but she has not in college yet. Once she's in college, I feel like her musical world will open up quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
So, last question I have, a song that you love that you wish you wrote. Is there one?
Just to stick with the funny theme that we've carried on for years. I mean, no joke. If you go back to interviews that we've done back in the day, Chris would make fun of me because I went to an Edwin McCain concert. Now, granted, my buddy works security, so I could go to concerts for free. But I liked Edwin McCain. I thought it was a good show. Now, granted, that does not fit with what we create or what we do. But, dude, if I could have written I'll Be... holy crap, I'd be in a different spot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I say the answer as a joke, but I also mean it very seriously. If there was a song like that that was on freaking Dawson's Creek and like making millions of dollars and had billion streams, yeah, I'll take I'll Be all day.
Yeah.
And so we actually played a show. It was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania at a brewery. And it was like the last night. We were coming back to Raleigh after that. It was raining. We were just like, oh, it's that last day of like our little tour. And no joke, they had a small room and a big room. The small room, Edwin McCain was playing acoustic.
What?
The big room was us. And we're like, it was a nightmare for Chris Martin. It was a dream come true for me. In some ways, like I was like, gosh, it's really funny to have this Edwin McCain love. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't listen to like any other music like that. Except for him. He's from South Carolina. So I've definitely reached out to him. I invited him to my like birthday party 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I never heard from anything, but I thought that would have been hilarious. I'm Facebook friends with his drummer. I say that makes me sound old. I don't use Facebook anymore, but I'm Facebook friends with his drummer. I'm not saying that I'll Be is the greatest song in the world, but dude, that put him into a different space.
Yeah.
You know, as an artist, as a creator, as a creative than any other song. Edwin McCain to me is not I'll Be. The other stuff is way better. But gosh, if I had an I'll Be,
that's cool.
I'll Be in a different position.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, I think that's something that's as a creative, a really powerful driver is to like be able to share something with, you know, as many people as possible. So, I mean, that totally checks out for me. I totally get that.
I have one quick thing. This is kind of a history question for you, but
sure.
I believe I read you were talking about when you tour with bigger bands, you get to know the crew, but never the other bands. But when you tour with smaller bands, do you end up hanging out with them? Because I saw you guys toured with the Virgin Marys, which I love, and I am dying that I did not get to see that show going on between you and the Virgin Marys. It would just be electric, I think.
We still talk to those guys.
Oh, that's awesome.
I love those guys. So I love to keep the relationships. So, I mean, the Third Eye Blind guys, I still talk to a couple of those guys when they're in town. I see them. Obviously, the Blue October guys, the Sum 41 guys, I still see them. I talk to Cone, not regularly, but like probably once a year, we'll reach out and talk. But Yeah, we definitely need to get to know the crew guys because they're out there while we're playing.
Right.
That's the one thing. Even when we did Bon Jovi, yeah, we met Bon Jovi and then he remembered us when we played in Raleigh. But the crew guys, when we showed up, they were like, you guys, blah, blah, blah. Like they knew exactly who we were. So it's like as the opening band or whatever, you get that sense of like these guys, the fact that you don't suck helps out a lot, right?
Right.
But like, yeah, you know, we keep in touch quite a bit, but like the Virgin Mary guys, man, those guys, that was their first time in the US. So like watching them drive through Iowa and just be like, what is this land of corn? Like, but yeah, dude, we keep in touch with those guys. They've gone through all kinds of different things. They just did a reunion show with their bass player, Matt, that we knew. Like, it was so cool, man, to see their arc and see their progression and just listen to their music develop. But yeah, we try to keep in touch with as many people as possible. But like, I'm the relationships guy, man. Even with drum gear and you guys, it's like, I'd rather know people. It's so cool that I have friends all over the world.
That's amazing.
From the band, you know, like that's cool to me.
That's awesome.
That's really, really rad. Well, Chris, we can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Oh yeah. Thanks for having me.
And being a guest on this pod, man, it's been such a fun thing to get to do with my friends to just talk about music and talk about this thing that, you know, is part of our lives every day. And just as listeners, you know, and I can't imagine getting to do that as a job. It sounds fascinating and like a dream come true.
I wish I was down there and we could have just done it in person. That'd be cool.
That'd be great.
Well, next time you guys are out on the road and come through Austin, please hit us up because we would love to come see your show. No, we'd love to come hang out. We'd do a follow-up of this.
I know, man. We keep saying we need to get down there. We never did Wauwatosa songs down there.
Wow.
We need to get down there and I mean even just play stubs, man, and just go out and do it. Like that'd be
rad.
That'd be fun. We haven't done that in a long time.
Heck yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thanks again so much. And we'll see you down the road, man. Play it loud and keep jamming.
All right, guys.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
All right, man.
Yep.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Bye.
We'll see ya.